Okay, we're staying here for as long as it lasts. At least I...
No, I'm kidding. I thought we all took one and they'd be gone.
It was a try, but someplace in here, there's an emergency alternate backup. So trust me, can't run me out. All right. I have no idea what we talked about last week. I was so totally out of it. Fortunately, there was a video there. So, I'll watch it sometime between now and the final exam. Are there any questions?
This is the best class ever.
This is going to be the best class ever. Okay. So what I want to talk about this week is search engines. And search engines are great fun. They are the research problem I work on. So this is the awful, now you have to click through the professor's research class. On the other hand, they are the center of the universe and the source of all meaning in life. So maybe I'll convince you of that by the end of the class. So I want to talk to you a little bit about what technology can situate that in the process that people use to actually search, so that you'll understand why we build the kinds of technologies that we try to build. So this is sort of the technology side. And then one of the things that you can take away from this and actually do something with is the question of if you need to buy a search engine, how can you tell if one search engine is better than another? So we'll talk at the end about evaluation. So this is the first search engine. It was developed right after World War II. It has all of human knowledge recorded on it, according to the author. It's not actually, you couldn't actually build a darn thing. It's all recorded on microfilm, because microfilm is sort of the technology of the day. And the idea was that it would make it possible to recall anything that you've seen before. Now this was kind of an unusual use of computers, because computers have been designed to compute. And this was Vannevar Bush, thinking about how computers could be used to help people think. So in any case, people have been talking about this for a long time. In this information hierarchy, we talked about databases earlier in the semester. And in a database, you have inside the database data, atomic elements, and you put it together so that what comes out is a response to the queries, contextualized data. So databases, in some sense, create information from data in response to queries.
not selling information retrieval systems. Information retrieval systems are much, much simpler. It's one of the reasons I like them. It's just a bunch of buckets. We put information in buckets called documents. So you take a bucket, you pour some information in, that's authoring. Right? Then having authored it, I simply want to find you the appropriate bucket and pour the information back out. But I don't have to make any sense of the information. I've just retrieved it. Hence the name, information retrieval. I'm going to retrieve for you some information that somebody has already created and put into a document. Now, people talk about things like knowledge bases as well, but there really isn't good system support above information retrieval systems. So we can handle very well-structured data, we can reason on it, we can handle very poorly structured information, and we can simply give it back to you, and we can't do much else. Right? So as we move to less and less structure, we can do less and less with it. Okay. So in a database, typically you have some request, you formulate the query, you get back your answer, and you leave. You have a good model in your mind, if you're a database administrator, what the database can and can't answer. And so it's sort of a one-shot process. In the database, if you get data that's not the right answer, the database is broken. Right? In an information retrieval system, it's not clear what it means to give you the right answer. I mean, if you ask a question, you have Google, and you type into Google cat. I'm thinking probably feline, right? But I don't know what you want to do with cats. I don't know if you want to buy a cat, feed a cat, you want a cat calendar, or maybe you just got an old DOS-based computer which has got a command on it called cat, and you're trying to figure out what to do with the damn thing, right? So maybe it's not a feline kind of cat at all. So a query cat is a perfectly reasonable query for all of those. There's no way I can know from the query which one you want, but the system has to give you something. So we get what we get. We get sometimes good stuff, sometimes bad stuff. And if I give you more good stuff, that's the business I'm in. So database people talk about efficiency, because all databases are equally effective. Information retrieval people talk about effectiveness, because information retrieval systems are designed to be efficient. We accept the limitations necessary to get that efficiency. And the question is, how effective can we be, which is to say, how often can we give you what you're looking for? So, think about this for a moment. If you were looking for something, presumably it would be because you needed it. If you're looking for some information, it'd be because you need the information. Now, if you already know what's in it, you probably don't need the information. So you must be looking for something you don't know. So the setup of the information retrieval problem assumes that you don't know what the heck you're looking for. And then the first thing we do is we require you to precisely specify what it is. You begin to see the problem here? Right. So this is one setup of the information retrieval problem. But another setup is exactly the case where you know what you're looking for. So how many of you have used Google to find the course homepage? And you know exactly what you're looking for. You'll know when you get there. You just don't want to have to remember the URL. You're using it as a URL lookup service by name, right? Okay. So these are very different kinds of search. And a system that's good for one of them might not be good for another. We could use it to find specific answers to specific questions, factual questions. So I'm not looking for some treatise on something. I have a question. What's Joe's phone number? And when I have Joe's phone number, I have the answer. It's almost like I'm using it as a database, except that I don't have data in the data structure. Anybody know the answer to this one?
Frank.
It's always the people who contest. Or, I may not be looking for something. I may not really know what I'm looking for. So, you can think of information retrieval systems as being systems for exploring. Essentially what I do is just imagine that I throw all the documents in the world on the floor here. It's a very large list. All the documents in the world on the floor. When I walk to some spot on the floor, that's my query, is the spot on the floor to which I walk. And I reach down and I pick up all the documents in the world based on how similar they are to my query. And that's how I get my ranked list of documents, by how close in some kind of space these things are. And then instead of finding something, instead of that being my goal, what I then do is read it, learn something, and ask another question. And I'm sort of having a self-guided teaching where I keep picking the spot on the floor based on what I learned last time. So essentially what we need here is we need a way to translate what's in these documents to spots on the floor that you could go to and pick up this sort of imagine a fishing net laid out there. So four very different kinds of information retrieval. And we try to build systems that can support all of this. When we do that, essentially we start out with some kind of user needs. Out of four very different kinds of user needs. The other thing that's given to us is that someplace in the world there are some set of documents, and misusing the term data here should be information. So I start out with the information on one end, there's a bunch of documents, and the user's needs on the other end, and both of those are given to me. There's nothing I can do about them. But they're radically different in one important way. The user is alive, they're a presence to the system. So they can do something, and then depending on the results, they can do something else. The data, the documents, are dead. They will be the same throughout the entire experience. So we're making an abstract assumption that the information in the system is then fixed and unchanged. Of course, in a real system, the data will update slowly with respect to the rate at which the queries are coming along. Right, so for example, web search engines might recrawl the web every week or so. Okay, so I've got a live user communicating with the dead office. Right, which is why I always think of this process as communication with dead people. And I've got two things that I can create here. Somebody could come along and give you a system. For example, they could give you a Boolean search engine, Boolean logic. Many people take an LBSG 650. You still do dialogue. Yeah. Okay, so you're pretty well fluent in Boolean logic. Yeah?
Another example of
having
nothing to take it with.
Okay.
But he didn't do dialogue.
No Boolean anything.
Well, they do. He has like a little bit like some diagrams. But.
Okay, so how many people are really comfortable with Boolean searching? Oh, no. Okay.
Enough.
What's that?
Enough. I don't like dialogue.
You're comfortable enough to know you don't like. Okay. So, that's the case where somebody came along and they said, I will build that system. And then, because it's a little complicated to use, what we'll do is we'll establish a network of library schools around the country, and we will send people to library school, we'll organize the profession that so in a way that forces everybody to go to library school, so that they can learn how to use this awful system. Right? That's essentially the setup there. So you say, look, I only know how to make one system, I'm going to link the system, you figure out a process for using it, and I'll tell you about facet analysis, and we'll do pearl growing, and building blocks, and all these other ways, these other processes of building queries, right? That's a case where I freeze the system, and then I can design the process. Of course, what you really like to do is freeze the process and say, I just like to ask for whatever it is I want, and then have the system give it to me. So it's not the process's problem, it's the system's problem. And so that's where the research end of information retrieval has gone to since the days of dialogue. But in the end, it's a co-design problem. If I design a system for which there's no effective process to use it, it's not a useful system. If I design a system for which there is an effective process, but nobody knows what it is, it's still not a useful system. So I have to design both the system and the process and the social structure in which that process is learned before I have a useful system. So, if you think about where all the problems are, the first problem that you think of in the sort of 650 world is, where should I look? This was the big one for me when I first came to 650. Actually, 650 was the first course I ever took here. I came over here as an electrical engineer specifically for 650. And then realized that what I was interested in doing was everything that was in 650 except I wanted to do it with a computer. So problem number one is, how do I know where to look? Right? How do I do source selection? If I can do source selection correctly, then that will tell me which information retrieval system I should use to search that source. Different systems being used for different sources. Then I have to do query formulation appropriate to that system, at which point my box can now do its thing. So you're probably wondering, what are the colors? So yellow are things that involve the user. Pink are things that are done fully automatically, or purple, depending on whether your color vision is really good. And green are things that information retrieval people don't think much about. They think of it as sort of outside the scope of information retrieval. So after I do my query, I get back a set of documents, perhaps ranked the way Google does. I can examine some documents and get back a specific document that will be delivered. So this is what engineers love to do. They say, look, I want to work on this part here. I'm going to be the selection engineer. So you tell me what comes in. In comes a list of documents. You tell me what comes out. Out comes the document you want to see. Okay, fine. I'll make you a real good box. So engineers like to take this approach that you carve big problems up into small problems, solve the small problems, and then say, we're done, right? Once all the small problems are solved, if I've carved it up correctly. Unfortunately, when real people use these things, they make a total mess of this for the engineers, because there are feedback loops, right? So I get down to here, and I say, oh, that should have been my query. And I go through it again, and I say, oh, I should have selected that source. And so I land up going around this loop many times. Now, if you think about this, there are three real tasks being done here by all these boxes. This first set of boxes, people haven't found anything yet. They're trying to predict what will happen if I select this source or if I issue this query. This is a control problem. It's like when I'm driving my car. What do you think will happen if I hit this pedal real hard and twist the wheel this way? I don't know. Let's find out. Right? So people will go do it. Okay. So people are trying to anticipate the system's reaction with what they're doing here. This box we call search, it doesn't actually search. Searching is done by the user. Right? What this box does is it nominates things for the user to look at. And then all of this process down here is involved in choice. So we're in a loop of predict, nominate, and choose.
Now, you'll see two pieces of coming down here. This search box gets used in indexing times. But how is it that we could take the entire World Wide Web? How long does it take to get a query back from Google? Seconds. How could I get a query back from Google in seconds if it's searching billions of web pages? With an index. So, what we do is we take the documents that we acquire somehow, maybe by web crawling, and we build an index in advance that permits rapid searching. How long, if I have to store the index on disk, is it going to take the search box to access the index? That one's on the midterm.
Under
a second.
Yeah.
All right? Okay. So, the real question is, how many times could I access the disk in a second? Okay. So something like 100 times. I have to build an index that in 100 or fewer accesses can allow me to answer the query. Or I can't give you the answer in less than a second. Anybody want to guess how many disk accesses Google needs to answer the average query? One. It's a really cute indexing system. Right?
On average?
On average. Yes, there are plenty of queries that they answer in no disk accesses. Want to guess how they do it? What's that?
It's in their cache.
It's in their cache. Right? So, what do you bet that the query that I will get a minute from now is very similar to the query I just got? I mean, whatever it is that's on, you know, people are looking for Monday Night Football. If I got a Monday Night Football query, when do I get it? Monday night, right? So I get a lot of Monday Night Football queries stacked up on Monday night. So I'll just go to my desk and build you some nice answers for Monday Night Football, and I'll stick it in my cache. And if you come along and ask about Monday Night Football, I'll just bring it to the top of my cache, and it'll go down to the cache until somebody else brings it back up. If it ever falls out of the cache, okay, fine. Then I'll have to build it again. But for very popular queries, I can answer it in zero disk access. Right? Now, how many words are there in the average web query?
Can Google like anticipate queries? So let's say it's coming up the St. Patty's Day, and they know that people are going to be searching for green drinks or something like that.
So
they
stack it
in their
task. But you wouldn't have to do that, right? Because the first person can ask and you give them a slow answer. You know, it takes three disk accesses or something. And then after that, you give everybody else quick answers. So you may as well let people tell us what they're going to ask next. So I don't think there's much advantage to trying to guess. I mean, we might do that with some, you know, perennial favorites. So anybody want to guess what the most commonly requested query term at Google is? So you can bet they just lock that one in. Because they say, see, it doesn't make any sense for people to do that. Because they're at Google already. Okay, so how, anybody want to try for how long is the average query in words?
Three.
Okay, so that's about three now. It used to be about two, but we have research results that show that as the query gets longer, the results get better, and we have empirical results that show that that number grows at about 0.1 word per year.
So people are learning very slowly to write longer code.
So, the way we design it is we design the index so that it takes one disk access per word in the query. I'll show you an index design a little bit later on, you'll see why that works. Alright, I'll show you what right now. So here's what we do. Let's say I've got these three documents. Nuclear fallout contaminated in Texas, information retrieval is interesting, and information retrieval is complicated. And I want to represent these three documents in my index. This is how Google actually does it. You simply make a list of all words. You might as well sort them in alphabetical order for yourself. That's not what Google does. But it'll make it easy to find them. And then you count how many times each word occurs in each document. So for example, nuclear appears in document one, but not in document two or document three. Right? So, the trick here, you can see this pretty obviously. Here's a document, right? The document is written vertically. So this is the document that has one contaminated, one fallout, one nuclear, one Texas, and nothing else. Okay? Now, another document that says Texas contaminated nuclear fallout would have exactly the same representation. I wouldn't be able to tell them apart. So these are invariant, these representations are invariant to shuffle. People call this a bag of words. It's like a set of words, except that you can have more than one. Okay, so these are documents. That's pretty easy, right? I've taken what you're used to as a document, it's got punctuation, you threw it away, the capitalization, I don't care, and just count the words, that's a document. With me so far? Okay, now, here's the minus penny part. What's a word? Well, if I ask you, what's fallout, you'd say, fallout's the word that occurs in document one and not in two and three. Right? So just as a document is known by its words, a word is known by its documents. Now, as you can see here in this simple example, there are more words than there are documents. Right? So I've got each document only has about four words in it, but I land up with more total words than total documents. What would happen if I kept adding documents? What's that?
You got more total words.
I got more words, so I still have more words than documents. How many words are there in the English language? Give or take. 10? 100? 1,000? Million? Million. Okay. So if you just take a large collection of text, the number of words stops growing at about 100,000. So I don't know how many words there are in English, but I know how many words there are in any large collection of text. About 100,000 of them. No matter how many documents you have. So there will ultimately be fewer words than there are documents. In, for example, Google. Now, if I want to define for you all the documents that had information and retrieval, remember our friend Boolean search? Then I could pull the information row here, and I could pull the retrieval row here, and I could see which documents had one in the information retrieval row and in the information row and in the retrieval row. Right? And I could give you back all documents that contain information retrieval. So they might have information at one end of the document, retrieval at another. They may appear right next to each other in one order or another order. But I will have given you exactly what you asked for. Yes? So, here's the trick. That's what we store on disk. We store the list of documents in which the word information occurs. And the list of documents in which the word retrieval occurs. And then when you do a query, we pull the two lists into memory, and in memory we do a quick comparison. So how many disk accesses do I have to do if I don't cache? And my query is information retrieval. Two. One for information, one for retrieval. Now, what if I have a very long query? Night of the Living Dead or something. How many disk accesses do I have to do then? What's that?
Three.
Five. Night of the Living Dead.
Okay. Okay, I wanted that job. Anyway, I've got to do more. What if I have a very, very long one? What if I want to give you an entire document as a query? And we see this, people will take a quotation. We saw this last time. People will take a quotation and issue it as a query. What happens to my cost per query? I have to do a lot of disk accesses now, right? So if I'm Google, I don't like this. Because I got to buy more disks. Got to buy more computers to be able to support more disk accesses. So I want your query to be short if I'm a search engine. So the reason why people want to type in long queries is because search engines give them small boxes. But search engines don't give them small boxes by mistake. They give you small boxes because you paid for the word. Okay, clear how this works? So if I want to do something like find all the words that have Clinton and Peso in it, that'll work just fine. Now I can prove to you that you can find any set of documents you want with a Boolean query, an ordinary, simple Boolean query, the sort I've just shown you. Here's how you do it. Give me the first document, and I will take every word in that document, and I'll AND them together. And, just to make sure I don't make a mistake, I'll take every other word I've ever seen, and I'll NOT those words. And it'll be I take a long time to type in the query. Google will hate you, right? But, what do you bet that will retrieve only the first document? I mean, that document and any other word that happens to be written with the, or any other document that happens to be the same set of words just shuffled, right? Okay. Now, I'll then take the second document, and I'll do exactly the same thing. And then I'll take every document in your desired set, and I'll do this, and I'll OR all those ANDs. You see how this works? You see that the query will retrieve exactly your set of documents. So here's my claim. Boolean search engines are perfect. It's the searcher that's not perfect. Because there exists a perfect query. The only problem is the searcher has no way of generating that query. Yes? So here's what we're going to do. We're going to make a search engine that's worse than a Boolean search engine. Because Boolean search engines are perfect. So any other search engine we make, at best, could hope to be as good. We're going to make a search engine not as good as a Boolean search engine, at which people are better at formulating queries. That's going to be the goal. So instead of saying, does this document match the query, yes or no? And now we're to say, does this document match the query to a greater or lesser degree? And we're going to do it using exactly the same data structure. So we have, for every word, the list of documents in which it occurs. Now, it's complicated, appears five times in this document, and never in any of the other documents. And it appears five times here, and once here, for information. And you ask for that complicated information, then you would hope to get this document first, and then this document, right? We just say five and five, 10 occurrences of your query terms. And here, just one occurrence of your query terms. And we would think this document would be better than this document. If I imagine five here and five there. Yes? If I counted the terms. Now here's the problem. You think if it's five times, it's five times better? Or is it maybe only twice as good? Because I'm going to have lots of words, and I have to know which one to give the weight to. So what factors should I use to give more weight? If it appears twice instead of once, and then it appears four times instead of twice, should I say, okay, well, get some credit for doubling and then more credit for doubling? Or should I say, oh, now it has four times as much credit? If I have a document that says cat, 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 is it four times as much about cats as a document that just says cat? So I need some function of this count. I don't want to just use the count. I'm going to want a function that looks something like this. So that when it appears five times, I get a lot more credit than when it never appears. But when it appears 10 times, I don't get much more credit than when it appears 5 times. So I want the function to sort of level off like that. Make sense? So this is the term frequency. How frequently does the term appear in the document? But now, let's say I gave you two terms in the query. Let's say I gave you Monica Lewinsky. And I asked you, which of these is a better term? If you could only search with one of them, which one should you search with? How do you all know that? What's that?
It's more unique than Monica.
See, nearly the entire population of the United States has never thought of that. I'm serious. So how do you put that into a system like this so that Google searchers don't have to know that? How do you get the system to automatically take a query that says Monica Lewinsky and make it Monica 1, Lewinsky 10? What's that? So you're saying if it's a short word, it's probably very common. And if it's a long word, then it's probably very rare. Yeah, that's brilliant. That would work. It's not what we do. But it would work. Any idea what we do? If I want to know which words are common and which words are rare, how do I tell?
Oh, you don't count them.
Yeah, you just count them.
Oh, God.
Doesn't that seem pretty easy?
That was kind of inefficient, though.
In what sense?
In the sense that you don't have to count every word ever written.
But only once. So this is what I do when I'm building the index. I say, here's a word that occurs in one document. Here's a word that occurs in two documents. And, you know, if I have lots of documents, I have some that occurred in 8,000 documents and some that occurred in 6 documents. Right? And I just record in the index how many documents this word occurs in. I call it the document frequency. Because I have this other thing I call the appropriately. Now, if a word appeared 10 times in one of those documents, I only count it once. Because I'm trying to find documents. So I want to find words that are discriminating, that tell the documents apart from other documents. Now, I don't really just want to use that number. What I want to do is I want to say, when it's in only one document, I get a lot of credit. And then as it is in more and more documents, I want it to get less and less credit by some function. So then, if you had some way of knowing when your retrieval system was doing well, you could simply try every function you could think of these forms, until you found a really good formula, like this one, which is the formula for these. This is the formula for this, there's the formula for that. You take those formulas, plug them into Excel, and you get that plot. Right? Now, nobody knew that that was the right answer. What caused them to know that that was the right answer was that they were able to evaluate when they were getting better retrieval effectiveness and when the retrieval effectiveness was worse. And then they tried every formula they could think of. So they tried TF squared. They tried 1.6 times this. So there are two key facts. The term frequency. How many times the term appears in the documents that you're interested in. If the term appears 20 times, it's better than if it appears twice. More, that term is more descriptive of the document. And the document frequency. Just how many documents does that term appear in? If the term appears in very few documents, it's a very selective term. We should give it more weight. Right? So we have term frequency and document frequency. There's one other factor that we pay attention to, and that's length. So if I have a very long document, and it has the term in it a lot, then I'll end up with giving it more credit if I don't adjust the length than if I have a short document. So now imagine I have a document that says, the cat in the hat went to the mat. And then I have another document that says, the cat in the hat went to the mat, the cat in the hat went to the mat, the cat in the hat went to the mat. Which one's more about cats? Neither, right? So I have to adjust for the length when I compute the term frequency. Term frequency, document frequency, and length are the three factors. And you can see where they are here. This is the raw term count. This is the length of the document, just the number of terms in it, divided by the average length of the document. And this is the raw term count again. Here's the document frequency, and that's N, which is the largest possible document frequency, that's the number of documents in the collection. And that formula is the formula that's inside systems like Google. Except Google has like a secret sauce or a tweak of parameters. Clear? Not that you're going to run home and write one of these. Now what that allows us to do is that allows us to say that we can give a score to any document that says for the query how closely this document matches that query. So you remember I was telling you about this scenario where you just walk across the floor to a spot and pick up a fishing net from there and it lays out by how far away it was on the floor? That's what it means to be in the ranked list. You're starting to see that, right? So I've got a way of laying the documents out on the floor. I don't actually lay them out on the floor. I lay them out in a 100,000 dimensional floor where one word is over this way. And another word is over this way. The third word, I'm not going to try it, is up this way. And, well, you just need a good imagination for the other 999,997. 100,000 dimensions, we can think of it in this two-dimensional floor. Okay, so here's what's going to happen. We'll just put the most useful documents near the top of the list, things that are less useful further down. The user can go down as far as they like. They stop where they want. And now they can ask a really weak question, like Monica. They got no clue, right? So they ask about Monica, because they heard some news story about Monica. And we've got the Santa Monica Freeway, we've got the Santa Monica Airport, we've got Monica Lewinsky, and these things all come back at some distance down. Right? And the user can go down and stop where they want, or they can reformulate the query. So that really is all there is to it. Information retrieval systems are just annoyingly simple. Right? It's just counting words. We make all these really stupid assumptions, like it doesn't matter what order the words are in. And then we run the algorithms. And they rank the documents in a decreasing order of similarity. It makes quite a lot of difference what you put around this. For example, if you index all the words on the web, then what you'll find is spammers will decide what they want their document to be indexed as. Right? So let's say that I decide that I'm selling vacation condos. And you are looking for vacations. You don't want to buy a vacation condo. You just want to take a vacation. So my page has got vacation and condo. And you just typed in vacation. But I want to look my page, I want to make my page look like a vacation page. So I just want to stuff vacation in 50 more times. So what I do is I get a nice blue background for my page. And then I get some nice blue characters that are of exactly the same color as the blue background. And I start my page with vacation, 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 in invisible text, in blue on blue, or white on white. And then you'll index my page as being about vacations, not vacation condos. Because I have spanned the index. So you have to put a preprocessor on the front to detect index spam. If you don't do that, then the techniques that I've described to you are easily taken advantage of by the spammer. So this was one of the big lessons of the web. All of these information retrieval techniques assumed that the people who were writing documents wanted their documents to be found, but they didn't assume they wanted them to be found on different topics. And so the web created this problem span. Now, a couple of other things you can do. How would you index a picture?
By the
word here, right? So it says, we practiced this. Click here and you get the picture. Right? Of them practicing. So that would be an Nexus practice this. Or maybe as we practice this, I, or maybe Conrad, we practice this, I started. So the words around the anchor can be used to index the picture. Now I can use that trick anywhere on the web. So let's say I have a picture, or let's say I have a web page that's about vacation condos, but it's pretending to be about vacations. Then somebody else could come along, build a link to it, and say, cool page about vacation condos. And I could up the vacation condo weight because I know someone else thinks this is about vacation condos. So this is a form of expansion. I don't just want to index the words that are in the document. I want to index all the words that you might use to try to find the document, which is all the words the author might have put into the document. That's all automated ways of doing expansion.
So that's sort of one class of indexing. I'm indexing based on what's in the document, the words that are in the document. And the game we play is the author has written the document not intending research, but just to convey meaning. We've counted the words. The searcher essentially has the problem of spiking out the author and saying, I mean, maybe most searchers don't think about it this way, but saying, hey, I wonder which words the author would have used in the document I want to read. So they sort of imagine the document they want to read, imagine the words that are in it, and issue those words as a query. You can think that what the searcher does is they take the words out of the document and issue them as a query. So that's one possibility. There's a second possibility, and that is the classic approach where the author writes the document and the indexer indexes the document to a controlled vocabulary. And now the searcher has a different problem. They have to imagine not what the author did, but they have to imagine what the indexer did, except now it's worse. Because back when the author wrote the document, they weren't sitting here thinking, hey, how could I get my document found? But the indexer, they have no purpose except to get the document found. So they're sitting here trying to imagine, hey, what might the indexer do? Or what might the searcher do? And the searcher is sitting here saying, hey, what might the indexer have done? And so they're sort of both trying to psych each other out. So if you do this, the word counting stuff stops working, because the indexers don't assign the same term multiple. So these tend to be exact match retrieval, and this tends to be where we get the pretext retrieval. So, two ways of searching, based on content or based on what somebody says about the document. I'll show you the third. The third approach is to look at ratings, to look at what people say about the document. So, here's an example. This is a document retrieval that you might be able to associate. So Joe here does not like this ride called Small World and gives it a D. But really likes Space Mountain. And our goal is to figure out whether Joe is going to like Speedway or Country Bear. Any guesses? What? Okay, and Speedway is that move. So if you know about the items, then you could do item-item similarity and just say, oh, you're going to like the Speedway thing. Because, try Amazon. People that like Space Mountain also like Speedway, right? So what we find is, we're trying to find, here's the pattern, and here are the people who like Space Mountain, or well, there are people who like Space Mountain. Joe, Nikki, Ben, and here are the people who like Speedway. Nikki, oh, we got it. Okay? So we can start to say from this, okay, people who like Space Mountain like Speedway. Here we can say, for Small World, Ellen, Nikki and John, and for Country Bear, Nikki and John. So do you see how Amazon is doing its recommendations? Right. People who bought this also bought that. Okay, so that's one way. That's called item-item recommendation. The alternative is to do user item recommendation where you say, well, look, who's like Joe?
Joe hated Small World and liked Space Mountain. Here, Ben. Ben hated Small World and liked Space Mountain. What did Ben like? Well, don't know anything about this, but I know Ben hates Country Bears. Right? So Ben is like Joe, and Ben hates Country Bears. So if you only have time for one, you better do Speedway. Right? And that's user item. So this is how recommender systems are built. Somebody have a question? Okay. The problem is, how do I get people to vote? Okay. So for altruistic reasons.
You take like proxy measures of what a vote would be, like purchasing something,
really?
Or you know, how long they spent on the site or something like that.
Okay. From last week. We can observe how people behave. We did that last week? Cool, remember something. So we observe how people behave, we use it to infer the ratings, and then we can make predictions. So I've shown you three ways of indexing content. You can index by what the content says, content-based indexing. You can have a professional indexer. If you do content-based indexing, you can do rank retrieval. But if you have a professional indexer index it, you get exact match retrieval. Or you can do this behavior-based indexing. Which is best? So if you imagine that the blue is really green, sorry, then this is a stoplight chart. It's a common way of displaying things that have advantages and disadvantages. You really do have to imagine that. Very handy way if you need to ever show somebody at a glance how things are going. So, free text search is a really good way of searching for things on a particular topic. In fact, that's what I introduced it to you for. Right? It's not a very good way of finding high quality information because it's just counting the words in the document. So if I want to know what high quality information is, I should look at what professional indexers think, and I should look at how people behave. So I have really good sources of those. So already you can conclude that free text is not the right thing to look at. You'd be much better off to look at behavior or metadata. The problem is metadata is very expensive. So I can't do metadata at WebSkin. Right? I mean, I can ask the authors to produce metadata, but that's just more content. It's just structured in a different way. So, I'm going to lose here on metadata, and I lose quite a lot of flexibility on behavior. For example, let's say somebody comes out with a new book. I can't use behavior to give you an idea of whether it's a good book until some people have read it. Once a few people have read it, then I can capture their reaction somehow by how much time they spent reading it, or whether they recommended it to somebody else, or gave it to somebody else. But I have this cold start problem with behavior. So I have to use something to get me past the cold start problem. So I have a lot of problems with flexibility for behavior and metadata, but very flexible for free text. Which is why you see Google searching the content, because it's very flexible, right? And the only problem that you have is with quality. And so the way Google made its market was to come up with a measure for quality. We've talked about this before. Do you know how they did it? How many pages links to the page? The page rank, right? So they have a way of computing it where you get more weight if pages that many people link to you, right? So it's a recursive problem. So that gives them a measure of authority. That measure of authority you can think of as behavior, because what people are doing when they're linking to the page isn't trying to vote for Google. They're building links to the page because of the use. So what Google is doing is it's getting around this problem with quality by moving over to the side and looking at behavior. And this is what you have to do when you think about the design of search engines, is that if anybody comes in and they tell you, our search engine will make your intranet search so much better because blah, 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 you have to look at this and think about what is it that it's not doing well. And how can you engineer their product into a complete solution that can meet all of the desirable characteristics. Okay, questions on that? Yeah?
Can we back up a bit again? Could you please describe or provide another definition for free text searching again? I'm a little... I understand the other two, but I probably don't get the first one.
I can figure out how to get this thing to back up at all. But let it loose, which it now will. So that business we did at the beginning with the content, the words in the documents, that's the free text, the unrestricted text. So, other questions? Okay, let's take a break, and when we come back, I will convince you that everything I've just told you is way too simple.
So if the bracket PHP, like, is there pressure?
So. I mean, by bracket you mean the water.
فارتفع رصيد الاهلي بهذا التعادل الى 63 نقطة، وهو الذي لم يتذوق طعم الهزيمة حتى الان في مبارياته 25. اللقب هو الرابع على التوالي للاهلاوية. من جانبه تغلب الزمالك على حرص الحدود بهدف دون رد سجله جمال حمزة في الدقيقة السابعة بلمسة فنية رائعة. يحافظ الزمالك على المركز الثالث ب 40 نقطة، بينما تجمد رصيد حرص الحدود عند 38 نقطة في المركز
Really? Okay, you didn't update it. Okay, no, I didn't. I got that code and I just haven't.
Okay, yeah.
The only thing, it could be.
There's a new problem.
And then, no, I didn't. I got that code and I just decided.
When do you?
So after, sorry, my.
There's also, there's a redirect page. Well, the page is a redirect page. That'll also be.
Nice, you know. And that's.
Redirect, so it's a body channel.
Yeah. But that, you know, he like wanted to.
Our ad was, we're going to do it for you.
And I do that.
So like, if they will give it.
Or, you know, I have. And we'll see what they want. So.
I'm glad he chose.
Well, it was also, I mean, so where's the.
No, you don't know what it is.
Or they might register.
Oh, I forgot. Oh, that's PHP.
So.
What I did is in PHP.
So, the only thing I couldn't hear was, I thought she was like, she forwarded.
Okay.
Is it a new file name?
I have sent out.
Oh, yeah. Okay, I just need to file name.
And so far, all I've gotten is, well, I have one person, I think.
Well, it's got more something.
Yeah, there's a whole series.
Do you want that?
You want the new stuff?
So is it any just people?
Well, what do you think is more new?
Not something I remember having.
So there is a antenna on the roof of a building in New York that is connected to a satellite receiver. The satellite receiver is connected to a machine that converts the spoken words into written words that can then be indexed. And so it's pulling down satellite broadcasts and indexing. And I'll show you an example of one of them. This is 42 minutes after the hour, so it's 5 minutes old. It's from a news service called Al Arabiya, broadcast from the Middle East. So the audio is not so good because of the MPEG-4 bandwidth. Broadcasting in Arabic and being converted into English in that 5 minutes. So we're running it through speech recognition and then machine translation and reinserting the speech the translated speech recognized results. We can do this for Spanish, for Chinese, for Arabic, and even for English, which is somewhat easy. And so programs in these four languages are recorded in a 24-hour schedule and then kept for 4 months. And we use these to do studies of how people search foreign language news videos. So everything I just told you is true. It's just exceedingly boring. Everything was in the same language. Everything was character coded text. It was a really easy problem. But now, what we want to do is we want to be able to search for all the information in the world. And almost none of the information in the world is character coded text.
Translated doesn't make any sense. So what good does it do to index?
Stuff that doesn't make any sense. Well, that's a great question. So does it really not make any sense?
A lot of it, yeah, a lot of it is just gibberish. In English anyway.
World championship team, Egypt, do you think this is looks like world championship car racing? Do you think?
So you're saying there's enough words that
Well, this is really the question now, isn't it? And so what we did was we got What's that?
I mean, that doesn't really mean anything to
you. I don't know. It looks like he might agree from Oslo. So what we did was we got a group of people together and we gave them tasks. And we have them formulate queries, find documents, and write reports to see if you could make any sense out of anything like this. And the answer was that often people could. Sports is actually a little bit harder, but hard news. You need a lot of context to do anything. You have the context to do hard news, but you may not have the context to Ukraine, for example. So I did one in Hindi, where I was the test subject, and I didn't know a darn thing about cricket. It was all about cricket controversies, and so it was quite difficult for me. Okay, but we can't make sense of it if we can't find it. So the first question is, can we even find it? And if you look at this, lots of the words are reasonable words, right? We got teams, we got match, it's tomorrow.
How are you dealing with things like dialects? I mean, it's not like...
Not very well, pretty clearly. So the way this system is built is that we get lots of people talking, and we transcribe what they said by hand. And then we show this to a machine that learns patterns. And then when it hears these things said, it guesses those things should be written. And then we get another machine. And we take the English or the Arabic and the English. And we have it, we show it Arabic and matched English. And it says, when you see this in Arabic, guess that in English. And we show it lots of this. And then we put these two machines together. And so it hears something, guesses the Arabic. For the Arabic, guesses the English. Yeah?
Are there provisions made for idiomatic expressions? Is that something?
So if anybody's ever said an idiomatic expression, we'll learn the pattern.
Okay.
Otherwise, we won't.
Okay.
And so we wanted to learn patterns that it's never seen in translation. And so the very last stage is we give it the Wall Street Journal. Just the entire Wall Street Journal ever been published. And we show it all the order in which the words occur in English. Whatever it comes out of this gibberish machine gets reordered so that it's in the correct word order for English. Looks like English.
Hmm.
And that gets you some extra credit. Right, so three stages of guessing. The acoustic model, followed by translation model, followed by a language model. And that's how the machine gets done. But that's not our problem. Our problem is, people know how to build these machines. And these machines, as you can see, are awful. I mean, they do better when it's not sports time, but they're awful. And now we're going to have to build one more engine that now will search the results of these things. Have I told you all about elephant guns? When I was a kid, we had an elephant joke book. You remember elephant jokes? So you might already know the answer to this one. The question was, how do you shoot an elephant? How do you shoot a blue elephant?
Well, the silly turns blue, shoot a blue elephant.
You jumped a little ahead.
Sorry.
For the blue elephant.
I'm messing it up.
How do you shoot a pink elephant?
Ooh.
Hold its nose until it turns blue.
Shoot with the blue.
Perfectly solves the problem.
There you go. Now, little did I know when I was hearing these jokes as a kid that it would actually shape my entire career. But this is essentially what we do. We find people that know how to do this, that know how to take some problem that we don't know how to solve. How do you index Arabic speech and match it to English queries? Well, we don't know how to solve that. So you find somebody who knows how to hold the elephant's nose until it turns blue. At which point it looks just like a problem you know how to solve. So you pull out your blue elephant gun, wobble in his nose, and shoot it. Okay, so this is the basic deal. We're given things like this, and we have to build search engines. So we'll come back to this after a while. So I promised you the class would be fun, and you were like, fun? We were doing math, formulas, counting words, you were giving us definitions. What's fun, right? So I promised you the first fun. So we have all these things in the world. We have these static document collections of traditional information retrieval. We have image retrieval, lots of images, right? I talked to you about how many images there were in the deep web. We have things like chat rooms. We've got video retrieval, audio retrieval, the kind of multimedia we were just looking at. Right? So how do we build retrieval systems for the real world? Because the part of information retrieval I've shown you already is this little part here, right? The boring part. The rest is the fun part. Okay, so here's the deal. We simply hold it down until it turns blue, and then we do the usual thing. I'm going to have some process here. It's going to be a different process for searching these kinds of things. It's going to require people with different experience, different search strategies. Search strategies that in some cases haven't been invented yet. Search strategies that you will invent when the technology gets here. It requires technologies that are adapted to the capabilities of this. For example, one of the characteristics of many of these things is that we know who said it. So one of my students is working on a research project that he calls Who Dat? Where you can point and say, who's that? Right? When you see somebody's identity. Because identity is such a strong part of all of these informal interactions. Okay, so one of the big mistakes people make is they always think what they're getting here is less
than what they were used to. What they're getting here is more than what you're used to, and less. It's got an error characteristic, but it's also got things you couldn't have otherwise observed. So here's a simple example. It's a document. It's got a logo on it. We can build a logo recognizer. I mean, we know that things that are round that appear on documents are logos. I mean, how many other round things do you find on documents? So, we can find logos. It's really easy to find text. In English, text is written left to right. It's got a lower line and an upper line and not many things going through the lines. So it's really easy to find the lines. It tends to get indented consistently. So you can take the document, pull the logo out, stick it over here, take the text out, stick it over there. After you do that, you find things like maybe there's a table in the document. You can pull that out because tables are really easy to recognize. You can, if you've got some systematic background, you can pull that out. If there are some handwritten marks, they're what's left after you subtract everything else. So you can get the handwritten marks and you can try and apply handwriting recognition to them. Handwriting recognition is a really tough problem, but if you have a sample, you can find other cases that match the sample. So when you take George Washington's letters, you can find George Washington in his hand writing something, and you can find other cases where he wrote the same thing. And then, what you're left with is noise. The things that weren't fitting any of your knowledge. So, if you can do something like this, then this problem becomes much easier. In fact, it becomes so easy that you can start to say, oh look, there's the inside address. Oh look, that's a part of the letterhead. Oh look, that's who signed it. And so you can build a field and index on what was originally a piece of paper. So the trick with all this is to go out and find the people who know how to do these parts of it and make a deal with them. You being the OCR geek, I'll be the search person. Right? You do your OCR thing. Tell me its characteristics, and we'll figure out how to build the search engine that will take advantage of the extra characteristics you can give me, like logo identification. So that's this part of the problem. But then somebody's got to come along with that part of the problem and figure out what search process can take advantage of these new features. So for example, in informal media, we often do social network analysis, where we see who talks to whom. We try to recover informal communication networks in addition to the hierarchical structures that you find in organizations. But then, of course, that's a completely different process for using those and word-based search. Okay. So I showed you this picture before. If you could search in other languages, what would you need to add? Well, you'd put machine translation in so you could see the results. That's what you were seeing here. Right, I was showing you an individual recording, and I was showing you the translation of that item. But that's not the only thing you need. You also need to be able to recognize when you found a document that you want to look at in greater detail. So you need some way of summarizing and translating. Now, when you summarize, you're normally trying to focus on just the things that are related to the query to pull out the snippet to help people recognize this is the document. But if you go to just the things that are related to the query, you may notice the parts that came very poorly through translation. So you want to have a translation confidence measure that you put together with your centrality measure to figure out what should be in your summary. Right? So the problem of doing this is different from the problem of doing this. There are people who study this problem, but that's a different problem. It turns out this is a different problem too. So we built a system that allowed people to search for foreign language documents, and it would translate your query into the foreign language. In fact, I think I might have our example from Hindi. Yeah, so here's a system from Hindi. Now, this is the actual system I use. We built this system in 29 days from a standing start. Somebody called up on the phone and said, Hindi. And we said, oh, shit. Because Hindi's written in this funky script. And we spent 2 weeks just getting the funky script right. And so we built, the first thing we built was a transliteration system. So we take the funky script. So this is some Hindi word that's transliterated into cinema. Now that's the transliteration for the translation of the word film. What kind of film do you think that is? It's a movie. Okay, so another way to find out that it's a movie film is over here. If I translate film into Hindi, into this word, and I translate this word back into English, it translates back into trip, or matinee, or cinema, or pee, or film. It better translate back into film, otherwise there'd be something broken here. Whereas this word, jahalali, translates back into periotonsis? Peritonitis. Lining, membrane, or film. You can see it's a different kind of a film, right? It's a film on the top of the water. Then over here, we automatically learn to say there's a film of, I'm looking at a collection of English and Hindi and saying this English word matches that Hindi word. So instead of showing you the Hindi sentence that came out of it, I just show you the English sentence that came out of it. And that's where this example of usage, there is a film of something, or the film now showing. So the point is, that's a different problem than this is, and that's a different problem than this is. So you can't just go along and say, I have to put a translation system together with my retrieval system. That's what you do first. And then you look at it further and you say, ooh, I need a few things that don't exist. And you start building. So speech is particularly difficult. Because, sure, you can do speech recognition. You can throw it into your index. And then you can do search in the usual way. But we went out and got a set of things that we could index of sample spoken content. And the problem with you do is it's got to be fairly large, otherwise you could have just listened to it all. And it's got to be fairly interesting, otherwise you're not going to find anybody searching. So we went out and we found a set of people who were talking about the Holocaust. And they were talking about the Holocaust for 116,000 hours. 52,000 people talking in 32 languages, telling their life story. And since their life stories were on average 2.25 hours long, which meant that if you started listening to this at the end of World War II, you would have just finished a few years ago if you listened to it 2,000 hours a year, a full work year. So, when we started on that problem, we thought the first thing we have to do is we have to take those stories and break them up into pieces. Otherwise, people aren't going to sit down and listen to these 2.25 hour long stories, except in very unusual circumstances. We actually found some scholars who wanted to hear the whole story from 100 people, because they were working on a book about the experience these 100 people had, and they wanted to hear the whole story start to finish. But when we worked with teachers, they wanted to find the right two-minute chunk to use in their classroom. So you get these extra problems of boundary tagging, of breaking things up into smaller units, because in text, the documents have a beginning and an end. But in speech, I mean, if I took all the speech I heard today, where did it begin? Where did it end? And you'd have to align it with my calendar or something just to figure out what were the separate units. Speech doesn't really have beginnings, ends, or titles. So if I'm going to do an information retrieval system, what do I display to you as the title? There's nothing like a title. Right? So everything has to be done with snippets. So they did this once for the weather. And they found that the best title for the weather was, "And now the weather." Because that's what people actually said. So trying to get it to, you know, have the weather report or something like that didn't sit as well with people. They wanted things that mapped into their mental model of what it was they were searching. Okay, so if I allowed you to plot every one of these problems, speech recognition, handwriting recognition, optical character recognition, machine translation, on this graph, and I ask you, I mean, pretty much everything works this way. As long as the transducer is awful, the thing that converts from OCR to the character-coded characters, so from printed to character-coded characters, if that's awful, then no matter what we do for search, it's not going to work. If I make it a little bit better, eventually get to the point where a small improvement in how much better my technology is gives me a large improvement in how much more of the content is now accessible. So initially, small improvements in the technology give me no improvement in the content. You know, I start with nothing, I still have nothing. After a while, further improvements don't do me any good because I can already search everything. So if you try to plot where we are here with this, OCR is way the heck up here. Right, so this is Google Books. Right, if I can Google Books, just go out, get stuff, slap it onto a machine, and have it be searchable when they're done. Because the OCR almost never makes a mistake. Right, when it does make a mistake, it produces a gibberish word that almost never matches a query. Which just means they occasionally miss some stuff. But they don't produce a whole bunch of bogus stuff. The stuff they find generally is what you were looking for. So the OCR problem is simply too easy to be interested. Machine translation is just about crossing that threshold now. So we know quite a lot about how to search foreign languages. And further improvements aren't likely to give us much additional searchable content. Handwriting is terrible now. And if it was improved, it'd still be terrible. So we can't do much with handwriting. I mean, we can do things like we can recognize your signature in the back. That's not as far as we can go. And speech is right about there. So right now, if somebody gives us a news broadcast in English, we can do a pretty good job searching the news. If somebody gives us two people having an argument, we don't have a hope. Right? And it turns out that most of the speech in the world is much more like two people having an argument than like news broadcasters. News broadcasters are very planned, regular, ordinary speech. Even doing this, classroom say, you'd have to put a close mic on me because the reverberation in the room would make current speech recognition systems not work well at all. Right? So this is where all three of these, if you pour money into them, they don't get any better. This one, if you pour money into it, it gets better. Now, that's in terms of what's sort of sensitive to a research investment. You can expect that over time, this will get better, up to some point where we'll start to hit some limit. how much content is being produced, how much new content is being produced in each of these four. Which one has the most?
Speech.
Then? What's that? So, which of these four would you put after speech as a good investment?
Plus with handwriting. There's more handwriting probably than there's text to text.
Really? Being generated? How much handwriting do you guys generate today? I'm guessing there's more of this. And then I'm guessing that, and then I would have guessed handwriting. The bottom line is, right now, the fastest growing technology is the technology for handling speech. And the scale on this side is largest for speech, which means that small changes here result in large changes in the amount of speech that can be searched, the kinds of speech that can be searched. Not true for handwriting. Not true for translation, not true for OCR. So what we know of in the market for OCR right now is pretty much what can be done. It's a mature market. This market's not quite mature. There's still commercial development going on. But the fundamental capabilities are all there. And so over the next 5 years, you'll see products coming out that work in this space. This is the place in speech, where over the course of your careers, what we can do will simply be changing. So it's the punchline. Someone's about to think about how you do this. Okay. So that's language. The problem is, quite a lot of the information in the world has no linguistic expression. It's images or video. And that's a really nasty problem because we can't very well match the counts of the words. Because there are no words. So everything I've told you about information retrieval doesn't work for this stuff because there are no words. Now, of course, we could still do behavior-based indexing. We could still do indexer-based indexing, metadata. But it turns out we can also play tricks. So instead of counting the words in these pictures, what we do is we count the colors. So for example, we have this Godzilla that is red and black. It's hard to see the black. Can you see the dot up at the top? This is a picture with a lot of red, a lot of black, and it's got some of this sickly green stuff. Right? And that's it. Here, on the other hand, this Godzilla has got a lot of brown and green. Right? So now what I can do is I can present one of these Godzillas as a query. And I can rank all the other pictures I have and find which pictures are most like this by doing query by image content. So it's content-based indexing. But I have to now present you with an example. I mean, the example could be a sketch or something. It just has to be a setting of these, some way of setting the histogram. Because there's no way of getting from the word query to the image query. Make sense?
Yes.
What?
It seems like you're going to get a whole lot of stuff you're not going to want.
So that's true. So this works really badly for some things. Like tiger, it's really not good for tiger. And so then you can, instead of just looking at color, you can also look at texture. You can get mathematical representations of texture, just like mathematical representations of color. And you can look at orientations of striations. And so you can start to do things that will work better. But still, they're looking at the whole picture. And of course, you'll notice here, if you were searching for this little logo up here, you'd be very distracted by the monster in the middle. So So what you want to do is you want to break the picture up and say, okay, well, I've got a thing here, I have something different over here, and something different there. Because you might be searching for things with blue sky. And you're like, okay, there's a picture of blue sky. So you'd like to do zoning on the image. And then once you zone the image, then you'd like to do color and texture together on the zones. Happier?
Getting there.
Okay. And then you'd like to hire a professional indexer. Or you might write captions. And then you might search the captions. Except the captions aren't very long, so you probably have to tune your weighting functions differently than you would for full documents. And so this is what people do. They do professional indexing, they do captions, they do anchor text, as I showed you earlier. Okay, so that's that. Okay, so I promised you at the end that I would tell you about evaluation. So, how do I know if I made a good system? Well, there are two fundamental things that I could look at. I could look at, well, can people use it to do what we need done? Do they know strategies? Are there effective strategies for using this? So that's a user-centered evaluation. So for that, I get a bunch of users, I train them, I make up some tasks, I give them different tasks in different orders so that I control for whether they're tired or whether they're inexperienced, whether they're not paying attention, and I try to see if there's a systematic improvement that comes from my putative improvement in the system. That's a classic user study. That's one possibility. The other possibility is I say, look, I build systems. I know what systems are supposed to do. Systems are supposed to find lots of documents, put them at the top of the list. Let's find out how well I'm doing at putting the top of the list. Now, that's not the real task. That's just a model of the task that's useful for evaluation. But the beauty of this model, this is system-centered evaluation, the beauty of this model is I can repeat this without more users. I hire the users once, get them to tell me the answer key, and send them away. And then I don't have any of these pesky users around anymore. Okay. Okay, so how do I know which rank list is better? Which one of these rank lists do you think is the best one? You like it. Okay. Anybody like any other one better than I? Okay, none of them have more than 7, right? And A's got them all at the top of the list. So A is a winner. Do you like C better than F? You like F better than C? You like F and C the same? How many people like C? How many people like F? How many people like them all? How many people have no clue what we're talking? You can see a reason to like F better than C, right? I mean, I've got, after I get 3 down the list, I got more stuff in F than C. If I'm going home after 3 anyway, buy F. Right? If I'm going home after 4, it's a wash. I still might like F because I found the answer after 3. If I'm going home after 6, I better buy C. Right? So I have to have some way that we're all going to agree on of telling you what a good rank list is. Here's what I do. I say, look, I've got no idea where you're going to stop. So, here's what I'll do. I'll take all the places you could stop, and I'll just average across them. That'll tell me how well I'll do When I get the average user in next, I don't know where they're going to stop either. Right? That's the best number I could get for how well my system will work. So, let's do it for C. So I get, I compute a number called precision. Do they know the definition of precision? So precision.
How many documents are actually relevant? How many documents out of all that are retrieved are relevant to your?
Right. So if I've already looked in C at two documents and one of them was relevant, one out of two. Right? If I stop at two, then one out of two documents is relevant. That's precision. Okay? So, if I stop at one, what do I get? Zero. If I stop at two, a half. If I stop at four, a half. If I stop at six, a half. You guys get better here. Okay, so, what we do is I assume that you will go down the list until you find however many relevant documents you wanted, I don't know how many that is, and then you'll stop. So I take the average across all the possible stopping points and I use that as my measure of how good the system was. So I say that for you, this system is a half. Any of the possible places you could have stopped, you would have gotten a half, it's a half. Right? You would get a half from this system. As your precision. If you go down for some number of all the documents and then stop. Lifting? Okay. So let's do it for E. F. That's going to be our next game, right? So I do it for F. The first place I can stop is here. What do I get? And then? Two-thirds. Three-eighths. Four-ninths. A half.
Five-tenths, right?
Six-elevenths. 7/12. I take those numbers, I add them up, I divide them by 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 possible stopping points. And that's my score.
Somebody would have to do the math to find out if it's higher or lower than a half.
And that'll tell me by a measure we call mean uninterpolated, I'm sorry, by a measure we call uninterpolated average precision, whether system C has better than system F for this query. But if your system F is better than system C for some other query. So I should evaluate this on the query you're actually going to ask. That won't work. Because if I wait until I already know the answer on the query you're going to ask so that I can evaluate it, I can just give you the answer. I don't need my system anymore. So I have to evaluate this on a query you're not going to ask and try to guess what the score is going to be on the query you are going to ask. Yes? Okay. So, which query should I evaluate it on? A bunch of queries like the ones you're going to ask, right? I don't know what you're going to ask, but I'll try to find some queries like the ones you're going to ask. I'll evaluate it on those. I'll average across all of them, and I'll report that average. So this is what happens when you buy one of these systems, and they tell you how well their system did in the standard evaluations. They had some way of putting together the different possible outcomes of their system, whether they're ranked lists or back match sets or whatever. They had some way of computing a score, given a topic, and the system. And then they averaged that across a lot of different topics so they could see that system C is doing better than system F consistently on many topics. And that's the best predictor they can get of how well it will do when presented with your topic and when you then go down for some distance before you start. Make sense? Yes? This is a picture of the amount of variation that you get across topics. does apply that precision number against recall. This is the fraction of the documents that could be found, that exist, that have been found so far. So this is a measure of how far down the list you are. And as you go further down the list, the precision normally declines. But some topics are very easy. So here's a blue topic up here. And this blue topic, you get quite high scores. All the way up. Some topics are very hard, like this this light blue topic down here. And so when we report an average, it's an average over an incredible amount of variation. And so you really want to get statisticians involved in telling you whether the difference that you see between two systems is a random noise effect, or whether it's large enough to actually be a measurable difference between the systems. So that's the third thing that we do, is we test the differences for statistical significance to guard against this kind of variation causing eclectic differences in the evaluation. Okay. So this is the bottom line on search. Search is not a technology problem. Search is a co-design problem with what people do and what machines do. We have, in an earlier class, human-computer interaction, we talked about how people were good at some things and machines good at other things. The user is uniquely qualified to decide what they want to find, and are uniquely qualified to determine where they found it. The machine is not going to do that for them. So the machine is always in this domination role. It's the user's control and predict and choose. And so if you design just for the machine, it's very easy to build a machine, a Boolean search engine, that allows for perfect queries that real people can't create. And so we build weaker machines in order to better serve the abilities, the unique abilities of the humans. People, when they think about information retrieval, they think about counting the words, or they think about having people indexed. And they don't think enough about how people behave. And before the internet came along, that was a reasonable choice, because we didn't have much evidence in how large numbers of people behave with respect to serious information. But now we do. The so content and behavior together give you more useful evidence than either content or behavior alone. And then we talked about evaluation. And when we did, we talked about how well it's doing. But the web search engines don't actually care about how well it's doing. What they care about is whether you use it next time. Right? Because they get their money for advertisers. And they don't get the money for advertisers if you don't come back. So if you give a user a consistent experience, they're unlikely to decide to go away on a whim. But if you give them a bad experience, they're quite likely to see if your competitor can give them a better experience. Right? Think about it. Think about when you switch brands, what's been the basis? Right? And so when we take averages, we say, oh, sometimes it'll be bad and sometimes it'll be good. And the web search engines are like, well, we'll take the good one, thank you, but we don't want any of the bad ones. So they actually drive towards mediocrity when they could be stunningly good on some queries, but they're not willing to take chances because they can't afford to be stunningly bad on any queries. They have to be as good as their competitor on every query, and then they can be better than their competitor on some queries. So the measures that we use for research aren't necessarily what they want to use in commercial practice. So there are many, many ways
I'm thinking about how to write it.
Okay. So, over the break, if you want to, you can come up and play with the search system and actually search some Arabic and Chinese. I haven't shown you that. And then when we come back, I want to talk about what's going on in your project. Okay. Let's take it.
I'm watching my
Question over break that you can't possibly search this stuff because that speech recognition is so bad. So, we'll just do a quick demo. Who's got something they want to find in the last 7 days?
Football, soccer.
You don't think we can find football or soccer?
Unicorn,
it's hard. Okay. We'll do Arabic only, and we'll search for soccer. Lebanon Soccer Cup Final NBA athlete? Video's
You're going to be seeing the final match of the Shamar tribe in Beirut for a while. Okay, well, anyway, it sounds... It sounds up. Okay, how go the projects?
Coming along. The project presentations are 3 weeks from today. There was a mistake on the webpage, which nobody asked me about. No, nobody asked me about. I found it. I corrected it. And then somebody asked me about it. Right after I corrected it. And it's not there anymore. That said that the project presentations were due the week before the project presentations, which would have been the project reports. Would have been really difficult to do since you wouldn't have finished your projects by then. So the project reports are now due on the same day as the project presentations. Well, yeah, that actually means that you're now trying to build the project and get the report together at the same time. But I don't want to take the reports later than that because then you'll be doing the reports instead of studying for the final. So I figured studying for the final is probably the...
How
about
no project reports?
We're
reporting in class, right?
So
you're
not nearly enough time.
I vote for no
final.
No final.
No, no. I had students vote for no final in one class previously, and then I got hammered on the student evaluations for having canceled the final. I said to myself, I'm never doing that again.
How about if we promise? We would never do that again. No evaluations ever.
There will be a fine.
We're on audio saying this as well.
My cousin's a lawyer. I'll have him draw the contract.
There will be a fine. So, back to the project. So, one of the concerns that I'm hearing from several quarters is what happens if we get our project to work kind of, sort of, but not really perfectly. You know, if it works on Tuesdays, if you have Internet Explorer 7.6.2, if your screen is 1024 by 768 and you hold it kind of this way, okay, then it's very nice. But otherwise, well, we know about the problem, right? So those are okay. The problems you don't know about are much less okay. So how do you find out about the problems you don't know about it? You test it. Now wait a minute. Who tests it?
People who need Linux versus Windows or Unix have different computers than you have.
Okay. So you want to just like say, oh, you look like another person. Why don't you test it?
Well, you might want all kinds of people have. How to search or how to look at a website.
And what do you get them to do?
Try to break it.
Try to break it, yeah.
So what you really need is like a 9-year-old kid, right? Okay. There are two things you want to do. You don't want to just test it with your, by giving it to somebody and say, here, try anything. Because then you won't know if the things you try to do work, right? So what you ought to do is you ought to give them a test plan and say, here, test the following things. You know, sit somebody down and have them test the following things. Now, who would be good to do that? Any of your classmates would be great testers for a structured test like that, where you tell them what you want tested. Because they have an idea of what you're doing, they have an idea how you did it, they have an idea what sorts of things might break, and they'd be able to do that. And then you want to find somebody who can try it out, who will find things the structured test didn't find. And who would be the very best person to have do that? Somebody else from the class? No. Who would be the very best choice? Somebody in your target user group. Right? So the client might be somebody who is not actually going to be the person who's using it. They might be the person who wanted it created. But they will have somebody in mind who was actually going to use it. That's the person who wants it.
So you want to run two kinds of tests. Now, when you run these tests, you know there are these testing laboratories like underwriters' labs, and if they have like a plug to test, they'll plug it in, take it out, plug it in, take it out, plug it in, take it out. They'll do that like 100,000 times, and then the line will tag on and says they passed our test. And their test was plug it in, take it out, plug it in, take it out, right? It was the standard test for plugs. You have to create the standard test for your kinds of things. You have to think, what kinds of problems can we have? It turns out there are two kinds of problems that people can have. One is, you might have some problem that affects all of the things you've done. Just a blind spot, you didn't think about it. The second is, you might have I really shouldn't do these things on Saturday morning. It's kind of a problem. You just screwed something up on one page. So finding the random problem is really hard. But finding the systematic problem is incredibly easy. You just systematically go through your system in any kind of a reasonable cut. Often there are multiple cuts you can take. And if there's a systematic problem, you will eventually run into it. So, for example, one of the tests that I always do is sort of a breadth test. If there are 10 pages that are supposed to work in the site, I'd like to go see each one of them once, just to see if they're really there, because if only 9 of them are at the correct URL, then no matter what anybody does, they're going to fail. So just any path that takes you through all 10 pages. You might have navigation icons that are at the bottom of every page that can bring you to the next page or back to the home page. You better test all your navigation icons. But you don't need to test them on every page if you copy them to subsequent pages. So you can systematically test your navigation icons on one page and make a good guess that they'll work on other pages. So you want to find ways of systematically probing for errors. Now, if you have somebody on your team who's not coding HTML, they'd be really good people to write up the test line. Because the people who are coding the HTML are the people making the mistakes. And they're probably not well primed to think about what kind of mistakes they're making. They're trying not to make mistakes. And the mistakes they're making are the ones they didn't anticipate. So if you have that on your team, that's great. It might be that you've got some people doing HTML and some people doing JavaScript, so you can write test plans for each other. Okay, so that's the testing. Anybody have any questions about content? Is everybody able to get content? Y'all are just happy. Or have you figured out that if nobody talks, we'll end early? This is your time. Nothing you want to discuss. Why is it that when we finish class, 5 people will immediately come up and want to talk to you? Okay?
Question.
No, not at all.
You need a person to bring you back there.
Yeah,